Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1. With Olay Total Effects Age-Defying Day Cream. Over 100 awards without paying hundreds of euros.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Hello there and good morning. Coming up today, Donal Lenihan and Brent Pope on yesterday's majestic win against the All Blacks. One of our greatest writers, Pat McCabe, on the darkness and lights in music and his novels. GAA and Aussie Rules superstar Cora Staunton on her life and career. And we'll have some great live music from the wonder that is Wallace Bird. Our text number 51551. You can email Miriam at rt.ie and you can find me on Twitter at Miriam O'Cal. Well, first this morning to that majestic historic win yesterday when Ireland's rugby heroes beat the All Blacks. I'm joined on the line by Donal Lennon and Brent Pope. Thanks so much for joining us this morning. Donal, have you any voice left?
I don't think so, Miriam. Sorry, no. I'm a little bit hoarse. One of those special days. It was unbelievable. It was a privilege to be in the Aviva yesterday.
It was astonishing. I mean, from the beginning, Donal, I mean, your coverage was astonishing in itself, just how you summed it all up. But did you ever lose faith? From the beginning, did you think we could do it?
I certainly felt Ireland were capable of winning. But everything had to go right because it's an outstanding New Zealand side. We've seen over the past 12 months, they have the capacity and have done so on three or four occasions of coming back from 15, 17, 19 points in arrears. And so, you know, as I said, there was a famous saying in Cork one time, Christy Ring said, apparently, you never take your eye off the ball, even when it's in the referee's pocket. when you play against New Zealand, the game isn't over until they're in the showers after the match. So, but it was brilliant. The crowd played their part. Each and every player, I thought, those coming off the bench, just stood up. And it was a marvellous occasion. And this was no fluke. This was, you know, one and two in the world facing off against each other. And New Zealand knew they were in for a match. And they were found wanting on the day, which was a tribute to the Irish players.
And Jacob Stockdale's try. And were you worried, though, I suppose, after his earlier attempt to chip the ball and obviously it was intercepted by the New Zealand captain, did you worry that might affect his confidence?
And not really. I mean, he's one of a number of young players who've come through the system in the last 12 months, 18 months. And these younger guys, the Jordan Lammers, Stockdale, James Ryan, Andrew Porter, They've known nothing but winning, be it with Leinster or with Ireland. They've had the success levels. Obviously, Jacob has come through the Ulster system, but he's just innate. He's a finisher. You give him half a chance and he takes it. I mean, he broke the try-scoring records in the Six Nations last year. So he just has that. He has the confidence. And look, players make mistakes, but it's the ability to bounce back from them and not let them interfere with your mindset. And that's exactly what happened.
And Peter O'Mahony, of course, Donal, as man of the match. I think he said in his post-interview with Claire that it's taken a while, like 100 and something years.
Yeah, and that's twice in 2 years. But look, I had the job of picking man of the match. And as I said in the end, I could have put 23 Irish names in a bucket and burned them all over and just put my hand in and picked out one because every player was just outstanding. But I thought Peter, he encapsulated the Irish approach on the day. He's always a player who puts his head on the block. At one stage, he was down injured. He could barely walk, but he got up and he made a try-saving turnover and tackle. And I just thought his performance epitomised everything that Ireland did on the day.
Yeah, stay with me, Donal. Brent Pope, I don't know, should I say commiserations? Or how are your emotions this morning, Brent?
No, my emotions are fine. I had to answer that question about 1,000 times last night. But, I mean, like I've been over here nearly 30 years, you know. I mean, I was in Chicago. I was equally as proud of the Irish performance, as Donal said. When you sit back and you look at sport, that you look at it, those occasions where teams, you know, perform to the ability that Ireland did. And, I mean, I think speaking to a lot of former All Blacks last night and friends that were over and stuff like that, you know, you're always proud of the way your own country performed, and I thought they were very magnanimous in defeat. I think that Steve Hansen said, you know, like, while Ireland don't have the official number one ranking in the world, as far as they were concerned, most New Zealanders, the feedback is, for me, is that Ireland thoroughly deserved it, and now, psychologically anyway, or mentally, they are number one, the best team in the world. And, you know, I've seen the transition from, like, Donal over the last, since I've been here, from where rugby has got to, and to be in a situation where they could even compete with a rugby country like New Zealand over the last few years, not alone beat them, and now that's been two victories in the last couple of years, is absolutely, you know, testament to the work that the Irish Rugby Union have done and various coaches along the way. But I just thought it was, like Donal said, it was inspirational performance, you know, from all the 23 players, and a special thing. But the feedback coming from me, is all the messages coming from New Zealand is, you know, well done, Ireland. You thoroughly deserved it. You out-muscled the All Blacks at their own game. And it was just one of those memories. The one thing they did say, the one caveat they did say was, let Ireland now have the expectation that we've had to live with for 100 years. Like, at this stage, if there was a World Cup being played next week, then it would be Ireland would be suddenly the team with the massive target on their back. So they're going to have to live with that. But hey, as I say, when I say we, speaking from an Irish perspective, we will live with that. And thank you. But a wonderful occasion. And I say, don't just a special mention to Donal, because I think it was just one of those special commentaries. You know, that I was listening to it. We did think he was going to run out of lung space and ears, but it was just a great moment.
Actually, yeah, Mary Hannigan in the Irish Times says it's a toss-up between you, Donal, and Peter O'Mahony for a man of the match, which I think is very well deserved. But I was lucky enough to be there yesterday. I mean, sum up the atmosphere and also the role of Joe Schmidt, how important Joe Schmidt has been to our success.
Well, Joe Schmidt, he's transformed Irish rugby, no question about it. Now, to be fair, there was a foundation laid by people like Declan Kidney and Eddie O'Sullivan before him. Mm. But I think, you know, there's a stream of young players coming through, and he has maximised the RFU, to be fair. I think we have maximised every skill and the resources that we have, whereas you look at other countries like England, France, with far greater resources in terms of playing numbers and money. And, you know, their system is light years behind ours. There's a lot of planning and development has gone through rugby in this country over the past 10 years. And we're now seeing the benefits of it. And when you have other countries coming to Ireland looking to see what we're doing so that they can try and replicate it, then you know you're in a good place.
But I laughed, though, and I'll ask Brent about this as well. At the beginning when they were doing the haka, you were like the world's leading expert. You're saying, I wonder which haka they'll go for. They've gone for the Kapa Opango?
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. Well, the Kapa Opango was Brent will know as a New Zealander, there's loads of different variations of the haka. Different tribes have different variations. But the Kapa Opango was designed in 2005 specifically for the All Blacks team. Now, they normally reserve that for special occasions. In other words, they might only perform that particular haka once in every 4 or 5 games. So I always watch which haka are they doing, because you know, oh God, if you see the Opango, you know you're in serious trouble. So, you know, when they launched that one, I knew they were giving everything they had today. But I also think, and people give out about the haka, I mean, I've faced the haka in my playing days, and it is a special moment. But I also think it is obviously special for the New Zealand players. But the Irish crowd, there was a stunned silence. They paid massive respect, but it also engaged the crowd to the point where, from that moment forward, everybody took off. Everybody got engaged and getting behind Ireland. Like when you look last week in Twickenham, the English crowd sing "Swing Low, Sweet Chariot" while they're doing the haka, which kind of drowns it out. And, you know, I think the Irish system is better. We stood, we respected, and then we reacted. And it was brilliant.
And Brent, finally to you, the Kapa Opango. Did you guess they would do that one yesterday?
Yes, I knew Donal was quite right. He's been out to New Zealand on so many tours as a player and a pundit. But it was rewritten, because I think they felt, the Maoris felt that a few years ago, that the old-fashioned haka, like I used to do, had sort of lost a bit of its impetus. So they designed that moving forward, and They don't do it for all games. You'll see them do it against, say, South Africa or Australia, these games, when they really need to up the ante. So when they came out, you know, I knew they were serious about this game. I dealt with the media this week in New Zealand. They were saying, look, for the first time that they could remember, this was an all-black team that was coming over, and Ireland was their focus, not England or France, maybe. So that was the other thing about this win that was so special. It wasn't a kind of a, I think, in a sense, they caught the All Blacks cold in Chicago. I think the All Blacks thought they were going to win that game just by, based on history. But this was a game that the All Blacks came and said, we need to win this to say that we're the best team in the world. So they were focused all week. They trained hard. They were ready. And Ireland just took them apart.
Okay.
I mean, the physicality of the match and special mention for the younger players that stood up. And even the guys that had to come in, like Josh Van der Fly and Kieran Marmee, and then had to big boots to fill, and just a wonderful sporting occasion.
They're absolutely brilliant, all of them. Everyone's so proud of them. Well, listen, Brent, thanks so much. And Donal, many thanks to you for coming this morning. Lots of reaction to your commentary saying it was absolutely brilliant, and you probably did deserve man of the match. Thanks very much to you both. We move on this morning and to our competition first this morning. Well, it's strictly for people who'd like to spice up their lives, or for any wannabes out there. I have a pair of tickets to go and see the Spice Girls, who'll be in Croke Park on Friday, May the 24th. So if you'd like to go along, you just need to answer this question and send it now and your name to 51551. All the Spice Girls had a nickname. Emma Bunton was called which Spice? Was it Sporty Spice, Baby Spice, Scary Spice, Posh Spice, or Ginger Spice? Let us know and I'll reveal the winner at the end of the show, and you'll be going to the Spice Girls concert. And now I'm joined for some live music in studio by Wallace Bird. She's brought along a strong choir called the Line Up Choir, who are actually in the cover of the Sunday Business Post magazine today. Wallace, tell me first of all about Aidling, because that's something you're very interested in, isn't it?
So we're doing this show in the National Concert Hall on the 22nd for Aidling, which is a regeneration and development programme in Uganda, Ghana and Kenya. And it's they're developing something called WASH, which is water, sanitation and hygiene. And it's a female focus to kind of bring some regeneration and rejuvenation and education into the remotest and poorest areas of Africa. So it's quite special. They've been doing it since 82 and building schools, medical facilities, and it's really good. It's beautiful.
And I know that big concert with you and Kathy Davey, David Kitt, Mundy and lots of other people is in the National Concert Hall on Thursday, the 22nd of November.
Yeah.
Which is great to raise money. But look, you're going to come back later and sing, but you're going to sing for us now with the lineup choir, and you're starting off with, of course, your wonderful song, Home. Take it away, guys.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Well, her playing has been called phosphorescently brilliant. And when Cora Staunton first put on the green and red of Mayo 24 years ago, she changed the games of women's football forever. She said she won't play for Mayo again. And in her autobiography, Game Changer, which is nominated for an Irish Book Award for Best Sports Book, she sets out her reasons why. She also talks about the highs and the lows of representing her county and her new career on the other side of the world, playing Australian rules football for the Greater Western Sydney Giants. Well, it's a long, long way from her club, Carnacone, for the woman who many call our finest female sports person ever. And I'm delighted to say that Cora Staunton joins me now from Galway. Good morning, Cora.
Good morning, Miriam.
Thanks so much for joining us.
No bother at all.
Listen, first of all, when are you heading back out to Sydney?
Yeah, so I head back on Wednesday week, so in about 10 or 11 days' time.
And you've a brother out there as well, which is great, don't you?
Yeah, so I've made the transition last year, obviously going out to have family out there, yeah. So my youngest brother, Brian, is out there with his wife, Denise, and they have two little boys, Jack and Keane. So yeah, it's busy when I'm out there as well, but it's lovely to have family out there. As I said, it made it a lot easier last year when I was going out for the first time.
And when did you think, Cora, of actually playing Australian rules football? When did that come into your mind?
Yeah, well, I suppose it was a kind of a chance visit. I was doing some ambassador work for the GEA October 12 months ago, or October 24 months ago actually, I was in Shanghai at the Asian Games, which I'm an ambassador for probably for the last 5 years, and I met a guy out there from Cavan, Nicholas Walsh, and you know, he had been working for the Giants men's team for a number of years, and he started to tell me that there was a semi-professional women's league happening that year. So that was it. Left Shanghai, came back and was playing with Carnicone and Mayo, and kind of about 5 months, 6 months later, I got a message from Nicholas asking me could the new AFL women's coach, Al McConnell, contact me. He was interested in getting me over playing for season two. So there's a few emails back and over and a couple of phone calls, and Al wanted me to get me out to Australia before the draft. So you're picked to play in the team. So the draft was happening in October last year, and I went out the day before the draft. I couldn't get out before that because we had been successful with Carnicone and Mayo. So I arrived out the day before the draft, met Al, met Nicholas and the club, and you know, signed contracts and decided to go over. Then once club championship was finished, and which happened to be in December the 3rd when we won the All-Ireland with Carnicone, and I flew out to Sydney 2 days later.
Yeah, and of course, is it still the sweetest win when you win with your club?
Yeah, without a shadow of a doubt, I suppose. You know, club is where it all starts. You know, as a 7-year-old, it wasn't with Carnicone, and the women that it started for me was with Ballintubber Boys, which, you know, is the same club. There was no girls underage club when I started, and you know, my career will finish whenever that is with Carnicone as well. And you know, I'll always be involved in the club, no matter what it is. You know, in 10 or 15 years' time, coaching or involved in some way. So yeah, certainly, you know, it's all about community, and you're putting on the jersey to represent your friends, your family and your neighbours, and you're hoping to do them proud.
And did you begin, Corey, your footballing life playing for your national school, Burris Carra, alongside your two little brothers or two big brothers?
Yeah, so one was my little brother that's in Australia at the moment, yeah, and my other brother who's 10 months older, yeah. So in Burris Carra National School, you know, I had a very good principal at the time, Art O'Sullivan, who's dad of the former Rosa Tralee, you know, Sullivan. So, yeah, so he was the main guy in school that pushed me to play. I was the only girl that played in school. There was about 100 kids in the school, and you know, anything, any type of sport, he kind of pushed me to play, and he kind of could see that I had a talent. And you know, from there, you know, I was addicted to it straight away and loved it. And you know, made my choice then to go to a secondary school in Ballinrope on the basis that, you know, I wanted to go to a sporty school and continue that through Ballinrope and obviously representing Carnicone Mayo and now the Giants in Sydney.
But wasn't it lovely in a way, Corinne? Do you think it would have made a big difference that, you know, Mr. O'Sullivan, that he did take such an interest in you and did convince you you could play just like the boys?
Yeah, I think he probably noticed straight away. I suppose when I was younger, you know, I tried out every sport. I played numerous sports from handball, racquetball, you know, volleyball, basketball, soccer, everything that you could play at that time in school. And, you know, obviously he had the more we call the girly things, the knitting and the dancing and stuff. And, you know, I never really liked them. I really liked the competitive element of the sport. And I suppose when I started to take part in whatever it was, you know, he could see that, you know, there was something in me that was very talented. And yeah, he kept pushing me and bringing me along and bringing me to tournaments along with the boys. And, you know, eventually obviously making boys teams and excel in them. So yeah, I have a lot to thank for my time in national school. It certainly started my sports career.
And you've always been very thankful, Cora, for all your coaches, and even reading your autobiography, Game Changer. You mentioned Finbar Egan as well, I think, because in a sense you say your best was your first.
Yeah, exactly. I suppose Finbar probably came in into Mayo when I was a 17-year-old, and probably had him for about 6 years up till about 23. But I suppose as a 17-year-old, I was just after losing my mother, and it was probably a very difficult time in my life. And Finbar came in to coach Mayo at that time, a couple of months after my mother died. And I suppose, you know, I really owe Finbar a lot from that time. I was probably struggling and probably not realising it at the time. But, you know, he was one guy. He was probably a coach that was probably maybe 10 years ahead of his time with his training and his training methods. And yeah, certainly has made me, you know, the sports person I am, both on and off the field. So yeah, he's a great guy. You know, I'd still have a great time for Finbar. Actually, met him on Wednesday. I was back in my former college in Athlone, doing a book signing there. So I met him, you know, and it was great to meet up. And, you know, you mightn't see these people in a number of years and, you know, mightn't even talk to them. But, you know, you straight away have a connection when you meet them because of his time at Mayo and what he's done for me.
You mentioned your mum there. Go right back and just tell me about your parents, about your family life, your mum and dad, where they were from and how many were in your family.
Yeah, well, I suppose, so I come from a family of eight. There's four boys and four girls and, you know, we're all very close in age. I think there's nearly just under 12 years between the eight of us.
Where do you come?
Yeah, I'm second youngest. So my brother in Australia is the youngest. So there's 11 months between him and myself. And then there's 10 months between me and my next brother. So, yeah, we're kind of like the Irish triplets. as was known back then. Yeah, so, you know, we're from Aurora, part of Mayo, probably about 50 minutes outside Castlebar, the main town. You know, my dad is a dairy farmer, has been for most of his life, probably spent his earlier days in the UK, you know, when he was younger, making money for his family at home, and then came back and inherited my uncle's farm. And then my mom is originally from Clonbur. We obviously don't know much about Mom's family, as you would have read in the book. Mom was adopted when she was a baby, and yeah, we don't know who her adoptive parents are, so we obviously don't know much from that side of the family. Yeah, Mom was a housewife for most of our grown up life. I think she started work when I went into about sixth class, so when I was about 11 years of age, and you know, she just done some part time work as a catering assistant in Mayo General Hospital at the time. So, you know, we're a very rural family. You know, probably didn't have much growing up, but you know, we're never wanted for much of our parents. They always tried to provide us with the best they could, and you know, got us all through college, and you know, we all turned out okay in the end.
It turned out great. The adopting thing is so interesting, though, isn't it, Cor? Because now most people talk about being adopted. But was it one of your siblings who went to just get her birth cert or something?
Yes.
That story in your book. Tell me about that.
Yeah, so obviously Mom got sick when I was in the end of first year in school, and she would have got diagnosed with breast cancer and would eventually end up having lung cancer as well. You know, and I suppose community spirit and everything decided that they'd do a fundraiser for Mom. Herself and Dad were 25 years married, so they'd done a fundraiser. Obviously, she was sick as well, and they decided to send her to Lourdes. You know, they're both Catholic and quite religious, so that would be Mom's first ever journey outside of Ireland. And when you go outside of Ireland, obviously you need a passport. So my older sisters were organising all that for her. So they were looking for her birth cert to get her a passport, but no birth cert was to be found. And my sister, my older sister, rang her from Galway saying, you know, Mom, we can't find your birth cert. You know, jokingly saying to her, you must be adopted. And she said, I am. And yeah, that's how, you know, my old sisters found out. And obviously in the book, I talk about myself and my younger brothers don't find out till actually the morning of Mom's funeral, where we're just sitting down, getting ready to go off to the church. And yeah, my father tells myself, my two brothers.
You were only about 13, weren't you, Cor? You write about this in your book, when you first realised your mother wasn't well.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, I was just at the end of first year at the time, 13 coming on 14. Yeah, so, you know, Mom would have been sick for quite a while before that, but knew herself she was sick, but As a woman with eight kids and, you know, I suppose rural Ireland back there, you know, she knew there was something wrong. You know, I write in the book that she sat in a doctor's surgery twice, and before she was ready to be called in, she walked out again. So she knew, you know, she knew she'd an idea there was something wrong. She obviously had found a couple of lumps in her breast. So eventually she came home from work one August, and I always remember because it was a roasting hot day, and myself and my sister were sitting in watching telly, and she wasn't too happy, and went straight down to bed. And that night she was still very sick, and the next day the doctor would have been called out because she was so sick, and the doctor would have obviously identified when he came out of the house that she, what was wrong with her, and he told her she needed to go straight to hospital. And I suppose over the next few days, you know, Dad found out obviously then, and over the next few days we were told. So yeah, she fought a hard cancer battle, I think, for the next couple of years, with most of her treatment being based in Dublin because cancer services down west were quite poor. So she spent quite a long time in Luke's and would go for maybe 6 to 8 week periods to get her treatment in Luke's, whether it was radiotherapy or chemo. And eventually then she would the services in Mayo General would have improved, and she'd have eventually got some of her chemo in Mayo General.
And there's never a good age to lose your mother when you're a child, Cora, but 13, 14, you're just going through puberty. It's actually a very tricky age when you're a girl. How did you deal, first of all, with her illness and then with her death?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, I probably only realised a lot of this stuff when, you know, when I wrote the book. You know, that's probably the first time in 20 years, you know, Mom's 20 years dead since July. So it's probably the first time in 20 years that I've sat down and actually talked about it, which obviously my ghostwriter, Mary White, you know, as a royal family, we probably didn't sit around and chat about it too much. Mm-hmm. Life moved on. It was difficult. You know, I was probably struggling a little bit in school and didn't really like the school environment. As I said, I chose to go to a different school than my older brothers and sisters because of sports. So I didn't really have that many friends from my national school coming to my secondary school, only my brother. And, you know, that's obviously you're not going to hang out with him. So I was struggling a little bit in school and in the school environment. And I suppose then the bombshell to hit at home, that probably even made it more difficult. It was difficult. You know, the only one constant I had through it all was that I was playing a lot of sport. At the time, you know, looking back, I was probably on about 13 or 14 teams between soccer and GAA. And a bit of basketball. So that kept me really busy. I suppose when it really started to hit, when she'd be away for periods in Dublin, getting treatment, and to get to Dublin from the West at the time was difficult. And we might get up to see her maybe one Sunday every 5 or 6 weeks. So, you know, that probably made it difficult. But, you know, life just had to keep going on. And, you know, I suppose I decided to do TY then in school because Mom was probably getting progressively worse. And while, you know, I did TY and went in, you know, not that often, you know, I would have stayed at home to care for Mom because my older sisters would have been in college or working away. So, yeah, I probably realised more in transition year the battle that she was having because you were seeing her most of the time and most of the days and the struggles she was having.
She was obviously a remarkable woman, though, Cora, because even in your book, I mean, at one stage, I think you say, she said, you know, when I'm gone, please don't cry for me.
Yeah, she was. Like, if you're talking to the family at the time, Mom was always the tough one and Dad was the soft one. You know, if you ever wanted anything or go anywhere, you'd ask Dad, you'd ask Mom last. I suppose maybe it was her upbringing, you know, the life that she had. She probably had a tough upbringing, you know, and had spent obviously a time in an orphanage and all of that. So, she didn't have any siblings. So, you know, she had a tough upbringing, but that was Mom. She was a tough woman. You know, all she ever wanted us growing up, it didn't matter. Once we, you know, had good manners, good respect, and, you know, we follow certain morals and principles when we grow up, and she very much ingrained that into us, you know. Yeah, she wanted us to do well in education and all that, but once we were, you know, mannerly kids growing up and grew up into, you know, people that she'd be proud of, that's all she ever, you know, pushed into us. And, you know, thankfully, you know, our family has done that. And yeah, she certainly, you know, I probably have a lot of traits that Mom have, you know, and you can see that from the book. You know, I'd be quite like her. I'd be tough, stubborn, a bit, you know, kind of take on a lot of her traits and characteristics. So, you know, that's there's still a lot for that's around.
She also had a great sense of humour because tell the little line she had, which I love, about, you know, not running after a man or a bus. I really like that.
Yeah, she used to always say that to my older sister. Yeah, never. There's plenty of buses. There's always another bus to come along. So, yeah, that was Mom. You know, she wasn't about, you know, once you were happy as a person or a child, you know, growing up, that was the main thing. You know, she provided everything for us. As I said, you know, we're a rural Irish family that probably didn't have much growing up, but she always made sure that, you know, we went off to school very clean and had everything. And I suppose that's another trait, you know, probably a few of my sisters and myself got from her. She was a bit of a clean freak and everything had to have a place. And, you know, she'd spend hours up at night time making sure the house, she was very house proud. And, you know, as I said, you get a lot of traits and characteristics from your parents. And, you know, I ended up getting a lot from her.
Yeah, I like her line. You should never run after a man or a bus because there's always another one following behind. But you found her really helpful over the past 20 years, haven't you, Cora? I know you feel she's helped you in your career. You still talk to her. You go to her grave.
Yeah, yeah, obviously, yeah, of course. You know, she's reared us to be, you know, strong Catholic people as well. And I suppose, yeah, you know, I probably as a 13, 14, 15-year-old watching her struggle. And, you know, she had a real cancer struggle. You know, she tried to fight as best she can. But, you know, I suppose the memories of her being at home suffering or in hospital suffering, you know, as a young person, you're watching that, you know, young people taking a lot, you know, as a young 14 or 15 year old, I used to watch that and I used to see that she'd always put on a brave face, you know, she'd never, you know, she'd always try to be positive and never be down. And, you know, she'd every right to be. And I suppose, you know, she was a very driven woman. And, you know, I suppose that's me probably on the sports field. And I suppose, you know, I put it down to me still playing at 36 years of age and probably being the other side of the world, picking up a professional sport. You know, it's probably down to her because she always said, you know, go after what you want and don't be afraid to do that. And, you know, I suppose I've done that. And every day I take the pitch, whether it's, you know, for Mayo, Carnacone or the Giants or whatever team I'm playing for, you know, I always want to do her proud. And, you know, I know she's still with me in every part of life, and she's with them, you know, the rest of my brothers and sisters, and certainly with my dad as well.
And she'd be so proud of you. It must have been so difficult as well when you think about it, Cora, for your dad, because, you know, you still had a younger brother. You're all quite young. And he's left on his own with 8 children.
Yeah, you know, I suppose we're quite a close family. You know, the biggest thing that happened, I suppose, after Mom died is, you know, Mayo football probably took off for us. Mayo ladies won, you know, four out of 5 All-Irelands in the years after Mom died. And, you know, it took us on a journey as a family, not just me playing, but it took my family on a journey. And they ended up meeting a lot of amazing people, families of the girls that I used to play with. And, you know, they're at matches and celebrations and All-Star awards and different things. And, you know, it took them on a journey. And, you know, when you look back at it, and as I had to in my book, them 5 or 6 glory years that we had in football, really, you know, just directly after Mom died, the year after Mom died, you know, was a great thing for the family to have, because we did something to look forward to all the time. And, you know, it was good for Dad, because he used to meet, you know, a lot of the dads and moms of the players. So, you know, it was a really great social outlet for him.
How are you such a good player? In other words, what do you need, do you think, Cora, to be a great player? I mean, it's not just talent, is it? You also have to read a game. And what do you mean by that?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, first of all, I'm part of a team. I suppose that's the biggest thing, you know. I'm lucky that I got a talent and I've worked on it. You know, there's many people that can't get talents and don't work on them. I suppose I'm very driven and quite stubborn. You know, I want to get things done, you know, whatever way that you can get them done, you have to get them done. You know, I probably put in a lot of the extra hard yards. You know, I've lucky enough, you know, have had very good coaches, the likes of Fimber in my life, my club coaches, Beatrice Casey and Jimmy Corbett, and people who I've probably watched and learned so much from. And probably have turned me into the person and the player I am. And I suppose, you know, I have a bit of a coach's head of me. You know, I love watching sport. I love, you know, every type of sport. So, yeah, I love the whole insight into it. And, you know, I was lucky enough then to go to Australia. And you think at 36, you don't have too much more to learn. But, you know, that's the time I've probably learned the most in the past 5 months when I was there, you know, under the coach that was there, Al McCollin. And, you know, he's been a great guy. And I've just, it's just different sports people. It's just that you're very driven. And you know, you want to succeed, and as I said in my book, you're probably a little bit addicted to sport, and you know no other way. But you know, it's been a brilliant career for me, and a brilliant path in life. And you know, I've probably learned skills and stuff that I couldn't ever learn in a classroom or in college or any other walk of life.
And obviously your greatest love in terms of sport is your club, Carnacone. Obviously it had its own issues over the past year or so. Are they all resolved now, Cora?
Yeah. So, we had a couple of issues, obviously, with the county board and being, you know, knocked out of championship, and 8 of the girls that, you know, left the Mayo team being suspended and all that. Yeah, obviously they're all resolved. Carnacone got knocked out. We got knocked out at Connacht final stage this year against Kilkerran Clonburn there about 2 weeks ago. So, yeah, season is over, bare 1 or 2 league matches left for Carnacone. So, it's a brilliant place. I'm lucky that I've been from Carnacone, and you know, as I said, we're very much a family out there. You know, we've girls as young as, you know, 13 or 14 on our senior team, and girls as old as 40 plus on our team. And, you know, we're just one big unit. And, you know, the girls on the team are there through the good days and through the bad days. And, you know, we're just lucky as a club. We've been very successful. And I think we've, over the past 20 or plus years, we've built a culture out there. And, you know, we're very lucky that we've won a huge amount.
And you're a complete all-rounder, Cora. And as we end, I mean, you're heading out back soon to play Australian rules football. You play rugby, you play soccer. But when you look at your Gaelic career, when you look back on it, 4 All-Irelands, 11 All-Stars, what's been your proudest moment? Or is that too hard to say?
Yeah, I suppose, you know, when you're in it and you're still involved and haven't retired, you know, from sport in general, you know, I'm looking at what's next. You know, what's next for me is that I have to give 5 or 6 hard months now to the Giants in Australia. You know, our ultimate goal out there is to get to a grand final and win that. So it's the equivalent to an All-Ireland final over here. And when I come back, my next goal then is to try and, you know, push on and win a county title, Carnacone, a Connacht title and an All-Ireland title. So it's very hard to look at achievements when you're still involved in it. But, you know, they're all very sweet, but, you know, I have to go back to your sweetest achievements are with the people there, you know, that are beside you and next live next door to you and that you've played with since you were 7 years of age. You know, I've girls, Michelle McGing being one that I've been playing with since I was seven, and she's still involved in her club. You know, so that's hugely important. So, yeah, and any of the wins, you know, have been brilliant. Probably the wins with Kearney Cullen and the last year's win in 2017 is probably the sweetest, but, you know, they're all right up there.
Well, look, Cora, safe journey back to Sydney. Have a great time there. I loved your book. It's called Game Changer, your autobiography by Cora Staunton, published by Penguin. And best of luck, because I know it's nominated for Best Sports Book in the Irish Book Awards. Thanks for chatting to me this morning, Cora.
Thanks a million, Miriam.
Take care. And loads of lovely reaction and texts have come in about Cora. But I'm now also joined in our studio by one of our greatest writers, Pat McKay. Good morning, Pat.
Hey, Miriam.
Thanks for being here. Listen, you've got a great event this afternoon in Smock Alley Theatre at 2:30. Tell me about it. It's kind of words and music from Soul's High Lonesome Valley.
I kind of like to think of it as a sort of an upside down, inside out sort of literary rambling house, if you remember them of old, or maybe a better way of putting it would be an old-time vintage radio show for the future. But your hosts today in the Smock Alley would be much more interesting than me, because interpreting various spirits of James Joyce, Hank Williams and Philip Larkin will be a veritable galaxy of stage screen stars like Kevin McGahern from Republic of Telly, I'm sure you know.
Yeah, he's wonderful.
Yeah, very interesting screen actor as well. The legendary Paddy Goodwin from Drogheda, whose album was coming out in April. There's a host of stars playing in that album, so look out for that. But the real stars of that album are his songs, and he'll be singing one of them today. There's someone from Monaghan called Liz Deary, who's a friend of mine, and she sings like an ecstatic skylark. She'd be singing Red River Valley and The Coast of Malabar, which I hope some of your listeners will remember. It's an old 40s and 50s song. Kind of the inimitable Larry Bowe, who'll be whistling Love's Old Sweet Song, and he has an album called The Troubadour Trail coming out very soon, and you can contribute to the making of that album if you want. But the centrepiece of our kind of psychedelic, traditional, punkish, Millen Pipe based fugue is the notorious Ian Lynch from the band Lancome. So that will be interesting. That's called Monsignor and the Apples of Summer. He'll be playing.
And people can go along, and actually, it's actually very cheap. It's part of the Dublin Books Festival at Smock Alley.
It's part of the Dublin Book Festival, and it's only €7 in, and there's €5 concession. So that's cheap at the price, don't you think?
Yeah, absolutely. At 2:30. Of course, you used to be a musician. And did you play the piano in pubs?
I played the piano in pubs anytime I got drunk. No, I was hopeless because I had the three chord kind of trick. But then again, you know, Hank Williams did only, you know, play three chords. You know, the Bob Dylan songs, a lot of them were very... So basically it was the feeling of the songs that I was interested in, and still am, really.
Yeah, and your work, actually, in a serious note, I mean, it's hugely influenced by music, isn't it?
It's all kind of moving towards music in the way you probably best describe yourself as a musician, monkey. You know, nearly everything I've ever written, whether it's of any worth or not, has the title of a song somewhere, either is actually the title of a song or it's going towards one.
What's this? Explain to me. You talk about synesthesia. Explain that.
Well, synesthesia is a kind of thing that's often applied to Bob Dylan, for example. You know, it's a kind of way of apprehending the world. You know, when Bob Dylan writes something like, "The ghost of electricity howls in the bones of her face," you kind of think, well, what does that mean? You know, and it's a way almost like maybe some children who, you know, who are particularly gifted or particularly not gifted or whatever, they see the world through their senses. You know, they can see the colour orange, you know, and things like that. It's kind of, it's an impressionistic, kind of an exaggeratedly impressionistic kind of way of looking at the thing, the natural world around you, the touchable world, the tangible world is seen through this prism.
Your latest novel, of course, Heartland, it's in the cowboy vernacular?
It's kind of uses the vernacular, but basically, like the people that you've had on your show this morning have covered all the ground that's kind of the book is attempting to kind of to either snare or to pay homage to, like the rugby team, the kind of triumph of the spirit there, then Cora's story about losing someone, that like all these aspects of human nature that everybody, without exception, goes through that are dealt with so well by people like Hank Williams, you know, all the great country stars, really, because it's, you know, they say that it has been contended that country and Western ballads, the best of them certainly, are like mini Shakespearean epics, and you know that they have a beginning, a middle and an end and a kind of a coda, and they can't try and explain. And work songs of the past and field songs like Paddy on the Railway, all these things, they kind of explain in very simple terms the really profound feelings.
I mean, you've had such great success. I mean, your books, for instance, Butcher Boy, Brexton Pluto, Winterwood. Do you enjoy writing as much as ever? Do you almost enjoy writing more because you've had that success and you don't have to prove yourself every novel you write? Or do you always feel every novel is as important as the rest?
Well, I never really enjoyed writing, you know, to be honest. Like when you say success, I mean, that's all relative. You know, sometimes you're successful, sometimes you're not. And, you know, there's so much emphasis placed on success and prizes and reviews now that it's, I find it quite tedious, really. But the thing about writing is that when you get it right, it's very enjoyable. But most of the time, it isn't. And, you know, I was reading the writer Paul Murray was saying something like writing a novel is like having a friend in hospital. And every day you go in to see, is he or she any better? And so a lot of the time they're worse. I thought that was a good way. I think
that's
it was William Gaddis line. That actually said it first. But that's pretty much, you know, you climb the stairs, you push the door open, and, you know, very quietly you see how's the patient today? And the patient, get me something, I feel really bad, you know. But one day you go in and there they are bouncing around like a child having recovered from this terrible illness, as children do, and you know, they want you to bring them for sweets and ice cream. And that's kind of why you write, waiting for that day to happen.
Where do you get your inspiration, obviously, from people and their stories? But when you decide, for instance, Heartland, how long does it take you to plan the structure for your novel? Or do you just start writing? You know, there's some people
write differently.
It starts
with a feeling, you know. And one of the poems that will be read today, we wouldn't have the time to read it all here now, but Kevin McGahern is going to be reading a poem by Philip Larkin called Dublin-esque. And when Larkin was in Dublin in 1969, it's very, very interesting because it catches Ireland on the cusp of change, you know, just when the 60s were about to kick in. And I'm 63 now, and in a way, there comes a time in everybody's life where they feel they no longer have the same stake in the world, that there are terms of references that they no longer quite understand. And it's not to moan or groan or complain or anything. It's just acknowledging that there may be things now that you don't quite grasp. It's maybe moving too fast, and certainly that's true in the digital age, you know. But anyway, to summarise, Larkin is at this funeral. It just happens at an Irish funeral. And he says something like, down stucco side streets where light is pewter and afternoon mist brings lights on in shops. So the funeral passes and he says, there is an air of great friendliness, as if they were honouring one they were fond of. Someone claps time. There is an air of great sadness also. As they wend away, a voice had heard singing of Kitty or Katie. As if the name went once, all love, all beauty. Why I mention that is that people, when I was a kid and my mother and father were all called Kitty. They're all called Kitty. They're all those names like Ellen and May, and all, but you never hear anybody. So all I'm saying is that is the world, strangely enough, although you warred with it and fought with it, it formed you in a way that the one I exist in now can't, because I'm formed in it, but it's not forming me. Whatever bit of formation had to be done is now complete. So to get to the point, really, Miriam, when I read that, a voice is heard singing of Kitty or Katie, I kept thinking of this kind of elegiac kind of passing of things, not in a sentimental way, but in the way that you sometimes feel when you hear the steel pedal of Hank Williams. It's kind of a lonesome wail. Part of it is your own mortality of things, but it's also the kind of a point in time you think, Larkin knew Ireland was moving into the modern world, and while it gained so much, there's something about Kitty or Katie that's not sentimental, where people's lives were interchangeable, people had an intimacy about them. There is a kind of a notion that, you know, nobody cared about each other in rural land, but nothing could be further from the truth. You heard it, Cora talking about that earlier on. They did it in different ways, perhaps, but people will always do their best, I think, to care. But there was an intimacy about that kind of poem that kind of sparked what eventually became Heartland. Now, you wouldn't think it because it's set in the remote American West of the imagination, but that's where it comes from. It's that old kind of recherche name.
And today in Smock Alley, how did you decide which poems and songs to include? I'm interested in that.
Yeah, well, the Dublin-esque one Kevin McGahern is going to read, because Philip Larkin really kind of encapsulated that feeling for me, that voice is heard singing. And because he's such a very sensitive actor, I think, you know, and he's usually associated with comedy and he's very, very funny. But I think there's a stillness about him that would really capture that feeling that I was kind of looking for. And all the other participants have various other qualities that can represent aspects of the book, if you know what I mean.
Mm. And the reason, I suppose, you love to hold something like that is you associate, I suppose, for you as a writer, music and song is so interwoven with your writing. It's one and the same almost.
But it's also very much part of the Irish tradition. Like, I mean, when I started writing, people used to kind of say, what are you writing? Oh, these Comalia songs for, these ballads with Comalia names like The Butcher Boy and so on. But again, in the time, shall we say, of Kitty or Katie, there was a kind of a sense, because Ireland was a very poor country and it was under the shadow of a much more prosperous neighbour, that its own culture, its indigenous culture, was in some way a little bit kind of uncouth, you know. And you'd have things like, you know, you're not going to sing one of those old Comalias, are you? You know, as if this was kind of pretty much inferior art. But then you read Bob Dylan's Chronicles, and he said one of the greatest influence on him as a young writer in the East Village were the Comalia Irish ballads. You know, and he'd quote thousands of them, like Lord Randall or any of the Clancy Brothers songs. And, you know, when I came of age then, 14 or 15, I started to realise that here was a literal treasure trove, a sort of a huge kind of chest of these kind of emerald gems and golden kind of images and so on, which Greil Marcus, the American cultural sociologist, had talked about the old weird America, you know, where flowers explode. And Bob Dylan has in that synesthetic way discussed that. But I felt that there was exactly the same available here. So that's really why I dove into it, as it were.
And dove into it so well. So today, 2:30, Smock Alley Theatre. If people want to get tickets, I think it's the DublinBookFestival.com. They can probably go along anyway.
They can go along anyway.
2:30
yeah,
is cheap, Alley, as you say, 5 to 7 euro. Yeah. It's called Heartland, Words and Music from the Soul's High Lonesome Valley with you, Pat McCabe, and also featuring Kevin McGahern and music by Larry Bowe, Liz Deary, Paddy Goodwin and Ian Lynch of Lancome. Thanks for coming in to chat to me, Pat. We'll chat again. We'll take a break.
Tweet at Miriam O'Cal. Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.
Joined back again by Wallace Bird and the great choir she's with here today, the lineup choir. Just very briefly, remind people of Aidlink, that concert again, Wallace, just before you sing for us today.
So Aidlink is, will I remind you about what Aidlink is as well, yeah?
Yeah, just yeah. For maybe someone who didn't hear at the top.
It's a beautiful incentive to, it's a rejuvenation project in Kenya, Uganda and remote parts of Africa, where they rejuvenate the areas. They bring in a system called WASH, which is water and hygiene. And it's a female-focused project recently where they're bringing in education systems. And it's just it's been going since 82. It was founded in Dublin and it's helped an awful lot of people.
And you're very involved. You've actually flown in from Berlin. Thank you for us today. And Aidlink for Turkand, which is featuring you, Kathy Davey, David Kidd, Monday, is on at the National Concert Hall on Thursday, the 22nd of November. And tickets from nch.ie. All money going to Aidlink. You're going to go over now. You're going to sing us out today, Wallace, with the lineup choir, with a song called That Leads the Way. Just before you start, the winner of our Spice Girl tickets is Orla Bradshaw in Kildare. Thanks so much for joining us today. Today, my producer was Sean O'Gorman, BCO Andrew Duprayer on sound, Noel Roberts, and we're going out and listening to Wallace Bird and the lineup choir.
Sunday with Miriam on RTE Radio 1.